We're about to resume, and I'd like to say a few words on behalf of the Council of Public Affairs before we jump into the question period, and I don't want to take too much of that time. My name is Terry Shillington. I'm chair of the board of the Council of Public Affairs, and as I speak, we're handing out these brochures. They're smoking hot off the press. They're a fresh statement about what the Council of Public Affairs is about, and I see lots of people here who may not be members. So we'd like to hand them out. They have a little... read them over and savor it, but there's a little slip inside that invites you to become a member and financial supporter of SACPA and invites you to give us some information back about how you get your information and if you have any ideas and so on. And so Cheryl and Gordon are handing out the brochures and kindly read them, and we would love to have you as a member and as a supporter of the council. I think we're passionate about the chance to have this discussion and raise these issues, and you can support that by supporting SACPA. Thank you. And Duane, let's go.
Thank you, Terry. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome you and our Shaw TV audience back to our SACPA question period. First, our speaker next week is Dr. David Swan. Dr. Swan is the MLA for Calgary Mountain View and the Alberta Liberal Opposition Critic for Environment. His talk is entitled Oil Wealth and Genuine Progress, Finding the Balance. That's an interesting continuation of our discussion today. And I remind you all that SACPA has a website. It provides audio recordings of talks and the question and answer session. You can submit comments to keep these discussions going. Our topic today is nuclear energy right for Alberta or not. Our speaker is Eric Williams. The question period is now open. Please come to the microphone, state your name, keep your comments brief, and limit yourselves to one question. We have a lot of participants today, so please try and keep it short.
Thank you very much. My name is Van Christou. We human beings seem to be very adept at fouling our nest on this earth. And with nuclear energy, the question that always arises is, how about the waste, and how can it be taken care of adequately and safely?
Okay, thank you very much for that question. During my presentation, I talked about all of the nuclear waste from the Canadian nuclear industry from essentially mid-60s up until 2033, so about 60 years of life. We mentioned that the volume of that stuff is essentially stored, can be stored in one place, one soccer field, under the height of a player. So it's not a massive amount of it. It can be self-contained. Within not too long a period of time, it's both thermally and radiologically sort of on the decline that way. As I mentioned, the future fuel cycles, I believe, will take care of that one. All of the fuel for the Bruce site is actually on-site and stored on-site safely. It's monitored. We monitor the circumference of the site to make sure that nothing gets off of that one. So I think we have a long record of that. The total amount is not that great. We monitor it. It becomes safer as time goes on.
Hi, my name is Debbie Gregorash. These nuclear reactors cost billions to build and maintain and everything, and I just can't see that the tar sands is going to give you a good return for your dollar. And I was just wondering, with Bill 46 coming along and having, possibly forcing the public to keep their mouths shut about any energy develop in Alberta, and the signed deal by Alberta to the southwestern United States and maybe all the U.S. to provide them with as much energy as possible as they want, I suspect that this nuclear reactor will be used to provide energy for the United States. I'd like that sort of cleared up first.
Well, on the cost, I think for nuclear plants, our cost competitive with conventional fossil-type plants at this time. So we're not talking orders of magnitude greater than anything else. They're cost competitive right now. I guess what happens to your energy out here, whether electrons or steam to get the tar sands and oil shale fuel out of the ground, is up to Alberta as to how they handle that. I can't basically address that on behalf of the CNS. And I think there was a third question embodied in there. Again, that's got to be a political decision in Alberta as to what they do with the power. When you say pollution, I think it's compared to other forms of generating energy, is small, defined, and as they say, gets safer over the years. It also basically extends the resource you've got here as well. As we mentioned, the one barrel or equivalent to generate two, if you're using another source of that, then you've got that resource extended for quite a bit of extra time, extra third. So,
my name is Gordon Campbell. Thank you so much for coming today in a fact-packed presentation, which I know is important. To quote the Bible, you speak as one having authority and not as the scribes. I'm not as one having authority. I'm thinking about 1947 and oil discovered then. And we, at that point, were one of the poor provinces of this country. We were hungry. There was all the signs of poverty that you see in the most undeveloped part of this country were present in our province. Suddenly, we seized hold of the concept of growth and oil sands. Growth, particularly, if I may be so bold as to say in a partisan sense, growth to fuel, in a lot of respects, the war machine of the United States. Growth that oil supplies that equals Saudi's supply to the United States to fuel their energy needs, which include war at various points in the world, sadly. I want that war to stop, and I want that concept of growth to stop. I want us to stop and say, who are we as a humanity, as a society? What are we about? Where are we going? Thank you. Thank you.
Well, at the outset, when we were talking a bit about the CNS, I said it's for the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. And we mentioned everything from power production to radiomedical isotopes, things like that, food irradiation. So the peaceful components of that. As far as wanting to stop the warlike pursuits of some nations, I agree with you fully. So.
I'm Howard Forsyth. By the way, you made your presentation, and it was pretty impressive. It's the inference from that, from the way you did it and how carefully you did it, is that the public is not very well informed. But how come? What stops us? For a long time, apparently, it was public fright at Chernobyl and things of this sort, and you apparently disposed of that. So where is this lethargy out here that you're fighting? Who are these? Is that us, the average person on the street? Or is it the oil industry? Or what's stopping it? How come your nuclear isn't moving as fast as your presentation would imply?
I wish I had the answer to that one. I was part of a utility in Ontario, and it was not part of our mandate, basically, to publicize or promote at that point. We were sort of servants to Ontario and the political whim of those in power at that point in time. Certainly the Canadian Nuclear Society, I think, over the years has tried to reach out, reach into the school systems, reach into the media with presentations, to move its conferences around to try to promote that one. But I see that as, I believe, sort of a shortfall on the behalf of the industry itself to try to extol the virtues of nuclear as opposed to anyone else's fault. We've got to do a lot better job, I think, of informing the public of what those opportunities here, and I welcome this opportunity to do a little bit of that today.
Hi, my name is Matt Hufford. Eric, thank you for coming from Ontario to address this group. I have two questions. Could you just comment on, you said cost competitive. Could you talk about the cost versus other energy sources? And my second question is, obviously, you need highly trained people to be at these plants. Could you talk about sort of the training and the retraining process that goes on?
Yes, so with the cost, I think I'll sort of try to keep it in general terms, but when a private company tries to come in and get involved with something that's going to reach forward 30 or 40 years into the future, and such as the investment that Bruce Power made at the Bruce site, and I'm talking about the TransCanada Pipelines and the Cameco shareholders, probably some of you in the room today. But basically, you want some guarantees back from the province, from the political parties, as to the fact that you'll realize that reasonable profit for decades to come. With that in mind, the Bruce A rate into that period of time was essentially struck at about 5.6 cents per kilowatt hour, which I think is what you're looking for. I believe the rate to actually produce today is in around, I'll say, the 3 cent mark, 2.8, 2.9. It could be a bit off in there. The Bruce B plant at this point in time basically sells contractually, and then a small component plays on the spot market for it. So it's sort of fluctuating from minute to minute what's out there. If we look at other forms of generation at this point in time, I think gas and coal would probably be, or gas and oil would be competitive probably at about the 5.5, 6 cent mark, somewhere in that neighborhood. We actually have 10 megawatts of wind at the Bruce site and about a decade of experience with that. And I understand that's up around 12 to 13 cents a kilowatt hour. And with a capacity factor of about 22-23% to be able to produce that power. On the training, it takes many years to train an operator, shift manager. For shift manager, it's probably close to 10 years to actually bring them in, educate them, get them trained, give them that experience. There's also a continual retraining process, which is monitored by the regulator to make sure that essentially all our staff are trained in all the scenarios, including all the emergency scenarios associated with plant operation. So that's an ongoing requalification period. Much of that is done on full-scope simulators. Actually, my son is responsible for the Bruce B simulator, but actually, so they can rehearse on a full-scale, you know, simulator issue, all the various scenarios, the startup, the rundowns, all the emergency situations. So when the real thing happens, it's sort of old hat in the plant. So, thank you,
Mr. Williams. My name is Robert Brand. I have a question with regard to power generation reliability. Would you care to comment on the fact that, as of yesterday, in the United Kingdom, 7 of their 16 reactors were out of service for, quote, maintenance?
Well, what can I say here? Bruce Power was a predecessor to that, was actually owned by British Energy at that, and I know there was a lot of sort of political involvement with their rates, with their performance over there. So I'm not sure if that's really part of it or not. They should be doing a lot better than that. I can only bring the thing back into the Canadian form, where basically with private enterprise and even with Ontario Power Generation right now, they're performing a lot higher capacity factors in that. I think you'll find they're up around the 80%. As we saw on the slides this morning, the worldwide CANDU performance is approaching 90-92% up in that area. So they are getting better. They are getting more reliable. If you're going to expect investors to get involved with them, you have to deliver that kind of performance level. So,
my name is Graham Greenlee. Dwayne, I just need to quote a few lines from an article here that was in a recent edition of The Post put out by the Parkland Institute. That will lead up to my question. Just a few lines. Yeah, it's not very much. This article is written by a geologist. And he writes, "The important geologic region called the Peace River Arch is the dominant structural feature in the entire Western Canada sedimentary basin, with an active history of periodic major faulting and earthquake episodes since pre-Cambrian times. Recent earthquakes had also occurred as a direct result of water flooding of several oil fields near Fort St. John, as well as water flooding of an oil field near Lesser Slave Lake, both areas being geologically part of the Peace River Arch. This latter, 1970, human-induced seismic magnitude 5.1 event was the largest earthquake ever recorded in Alberta. After a relatively quiet period of time, the Peace River Arch history of episodic seismicity has been awakened by the oil patch, with the potential for more man-made earthquakes to follow as a result of massive in-situ steam injection operations in the nearby Peace River oil sands areas. In other words, building a nuclear power plant on the Peace River Arch on top of mapped major fault trends published by the Alberta Research Council and the Alberta Geological Survey in 1994 would be a monumental scientific blunder." Okay, that's what he says. My question is, are nuclear power plants, Eric, generally built to be earthquake resistant.
Well, one, during the siting of a nuclear plant, of course, they look at the ground, the structure, and everything else, and they're, you know, they're going to make sure that the where they build them is in a safe location to do that. So that's all part of the siting review engineering that goes into it. Bruce B is a seismically qualified plant, so they're designed to basically take, I believe, a magnitude 6 or 7 earthquake at fairly close proximity, which we haven't had in that area for a long, long time. So the new plants basically have that and all the features of it.
Hi. My name is Mark. You were talking primarily about the CANDU reactor?
It's Canadian technology, yes.
Yeah. I'm wondering if that technology is not outmoded. I mean, it's just not keeping up with the current technology, like the things that they're using in Europe. I mean, you were saying that, you know, a football field full of waste 6 feet high isn't very much. That sounds like quite a bit to me. And you didn't mention much about the plutonium that it produces. I just wonder if there's better, and you didn't mention breeder reactors.
Okay. I guess on the waste one more time, that's 70 years of waste. I don't know any other industry that can claim that's what we generated in waste over 70 years of production for everything in Canada. So I'll stand behind that one there. There are, Atomic Energy of Canada, and I come from the Canadian base, and we're a Canadian society, so we tend to do that. Basically, quite proud of that technology. They're developing future generation reactors as well, so it's not just the existing fleet. And some of the private producers in Canada are indeed looking worldwide for the best technology. You know, private investors don't want just what the Canadian thing was. They're going to take a look at what the best out there is, and this includes the Bruce site. And then Duncan Hawthorne is on record as saying that. We're going to get, for future new build, we're going to get the best there is available in return for our shareholders. So.
Plutonium.
Pardon? There is a component within our fuel. It's within the matrix. It's a small component of that. It's there. Future generations of reactors, that's going to be part of the fuel, and it'll basically go away. So it's one of the fission products. It's got to be properly managed in the long term in the future.
Hello, sir. My name is Dennis King, and you've elaborated on some of the other waste products, but could you comment on the effect on fresh water supplies compared to the oil industry? That's what we're hearing about. The oil sands is the extensive damage that's done to our water supplies. How does that compare with the nuclear industry?
Well, we're very sensitive to that. The repositories that we have for the medium, high, low, and high-level waste basically are sort of all monitored at their, I'll call it, footing drains or things like that. So we're cautious of what is there. A number of other containment systems should be containing that one. But essentially, we are monitoring what happens to any groundwater seepage, et cetera, that may go out of that one. So the site is hardened. It's monitored. I'm sure if anything came out of that, we're going to have to take action to resolve that. But at that point in time, we're not seeing it. So we are keeping an eye on, we are watching it.
I think the questioners, if we could just go for a minute, the questioner might be interested in the cooling water requirements.
Okay. Obviously, a large nuclear plant uses a lot of water to cool it. I believe it's up around millions of gallons per minute coming out of the lake and going back in. This water is put back into the lake. There's a regulatory limit on the upper limit for the temperature variation, which is 15 degrees C. Essentially, studies done at our plant, at the Bruce site, basically have that water dissipated back into the lake within 1 mile. So within 1 mile, you cannot tell the difference of the plume, plus or minus a degree. And by that time, it's about 85% has dissipated into the atmosphere. So the fish love it. If you're a fisherman, it's a great place to be. But essentially, talking for the whole lake any further out than that, there aren't any sort of discernible impact on that.
Thanks for coming this afternoon. My name is Rena Wass, and I just want to ask some more about this water. You talk about heavy water. Can you explain what it is and how much of it is of a toxic nature? I know in northern Alberta we've got one of the largest toxic lakes on the planet right now as a result of the fossil fuel industry. The other part B of my question is, NMAX just built a wind plant in Tabor. There's been resistance to wind power here, but it's opening up. They spent $125 million, and that $125 million is going to power 30,000 homes. There's going to be no toxic pollutants of any kind. I align with that kind of philosophy. Now, dollar for dollar, $125 million for 30,000 homes, how many billions to build a reactor and how many homes? I mean, have you done some studies there? Thank you.
Okay. First of all, heavy water. Heavy water is a natural component of light water, but one part in 7,000. It's sort of refined out through chemical heat processes. Heavy water in the plant is a very expensive commodity. We keep it clean. It's recycled. It's upgraded. But essentially, it's a known commodity within the plant. So unless there's a leak of some description and it dissipates back into the lake itself, it's basically not an issue. One of the products generated during the reactions is something called tritium, which is basically we maintain that basically to minimize dose to the employees in the station. Tritium is also valuable for airport lightings, emergency lighting, things like that. So it has its own use in other services as well. So I think, yeah, we manage the heavy water, we refine it, we upgrade it. Wind, I would support you. If wind was capable of providing all our power right now, I'd be voting for wind. Okay, but it's not. We're well short of that. And unfortunately, in our society today, we need energy basically on demand 24/7. So we need that to do there. Right now, with our given technologies, the technology we have and looking forward in the foreseeable future says we need something else. From where I'm sitting, I think nuclear is the best stage to be able to provide that for us. So.
Thank you, Eric. I've been very impressed with your presentation. My name is Peter Green. I do have one question, though. While I'm generally in favor of nuclear energy as being a viable source of power, I do have a number of concerns, and one of them is that it seems to me that it's important to be sure that we are comparing apples with apples. And you mentioned some impressive figures about the small quantity of waste that is involved in this sort of thing. However, it does seem to me that that small quantity of waste is incredibly more hazardous to the environment than a much larger quantity from a conventional source of power. And I wonder how you would equate that in terms of what happens if, and somebody mentioned an earthquake, what happens if an earthquake ruptures the containment dike or whatever it is that's going to compare this, and how are you going to cope with the effect of that in the environment? Thank you.
Well, the repositories that we said are small, and as they say, there's a lot of other things we can compare to, which I think have a lot greater impact on our society, both through toxicity and just pure volume and everything else. From the containment, the fuel remains sealed in those the fuel bundles we saw, and then within basically containment structures when they're placed into these underground repositories. So they are sort of, I'll say, seismically qualified. They're hardened at this point in time to be able to resist that into the long term. One of the reasons that these long-term repositories have been so long in coming is the extensive research and questioning and long-term viability of that fuel. I mentioned also as well that the reactivity associated with this is declining, and I mentioned it back down to natural as found conditions within about 500 years, sort of as average finished products within that. So I think that's going to be reducing it for future generations. And I guess in my mind, I can picture this soccer field or a number of smaller components of that in various areas and be able to take care of that as compared to a lot of the other ways we're sort of degrading our beautiful Earth. So.
Good afternoon. My name is Eric Williams. I, too, am an Anglican lay reader as well, incidentally. My questions are two. One, is everybody on site at the Bruce Power place required to wear a patch of radio-sensitive film, radioactivity-sensitive film, so that the exposure to everybody on site is monitored? One. Two, what insurance liability does Bruce Power carry, and what are the implications of extending such onto an Alberta site, for example?
Radiology monitoring. We mentioned we had a 2,800-acre site. That's a big, big site. We have the two major power plants on there. We have the waste facilities where we store the fuel, the used fuel and other products. Anybody in those areas has to be monitored, so they do wear the film badges. They also have to give a bioassay sample on a regular basis. They also have to be whole body monitored on a regular basis. Monday afternoon, I was in on a fire walk down at Bruce A. I was in the station about 3 hours. I was in the new fuel bay, the irradiated fuel bay, and the fueling machine maintenance area. I probably monitored about 42 times. I had to walk through monitors. I went around my ways on that, so in and out. So we are continually monitored all the way. So on that basis, the second part of the question, my mind's escaped here. So. Insurance liability, there are regulations as to how much we cover. It has been increasing in recent years. And basically the station's license basically have to comply with that one, and it has been sneaking upwards. The number at the moment is becoming a big number again, though. But I can get back to you on that one, Eric, just to know what that is. But it's
in the event of a turnover.
Yeah. The insurance policy covers as much as possible, and then it's probably back to the government basically to do the rest. So, yeah. But I mean that's a responsible level as well. I think for the industry itself, it's to be able to function, provide all the benefits it does to mankind. I think that's not an unreasonable risk to take.
Thank you very much for such a great talk, Eric. My name is Michael Cormack, and I'm the local Liberal candidate for the next federal election. Recently, I heard or read that the Americans have been using bullets made from presumably the spent rods. Now, what I've heard from you and other people is that we have been only on the go for about 70 years, yet it takes about 500 years to expend all the radioactivity. So I am wondering about if you would like to comment on that or the ethics of it, like when you're using bullets that might be radioactive as well. Okay?
I personally wasn't aware of it, and I certainly wouldn't condone it at this point of view, so I really don't have a comment, I'm afraid, on that. So, yeah.
I think the questioner this time, I think, is referring to depleted uranium, which does not come from spent fuel.
Okay, yeah.
My name is Cheryl Bradley, and I don't believe much has been said about the uranium mining aspect of the nuclear industry. It seems that some of the strongest opposition to the industry comes from a province like Saskatchewan, where the uranium is mined. And I understand there are a fair number of issues around pollutants, air pollutants, and water pollutants from mining. As well as just the actual physical destruction of a landscape from uranium mining. And so I'm wondering if you can speak to some of those, I guess you'd call upstream impacts.
I know in Ontario it's been a big issue, an increased vigilance with regard to these areas, the cleanup of areas that were previously accepted practice to let it basically the flow away. So there's major cleanup there. So I think the vigilance on it, the attention to this matter is increasing in importance, and I think they're doing a lot better job at cleaning up their existing opportunities and making sure that in the future we do a better job of it. I think that's probably as much as I can say on that at the moment. So.
Knut Peterson is my name. I wonder if you could comment on the vulnerability of a nuclear power plant in case of a terrorist attack. There seems to be a lot of scare in that regard.
I had a thought in my mind. I was going to head off on that one. I've been at site for 33 years. The security has increased dramatically, I'd say, the last decade at the Bruce site. I used to be with the Royal Canadian Air Force, and part of my training there was as a, quote, saboteur during drills and emergencies for other stations. And for one, I would not want to try to run on the Bruce site at this point in time. So from a security point of view, it's well patrolled. Some signs on the fence that say it's an armed area. You enter at your own risk, sort of in all respects. From the vantage point of sort of we saw the reactor building in one of the slides right now, where you know the majority of the radiated fuel, the nuclear process is taking place on that one. And the thought is of trying to damage that with, you know, bombs or missiles flying into it or stuff, I think is you're not going to do significant damage to that other than the loss of that unit off the line and the loss of energy production associated with it. So I think from a security point of view, and certainly in the regulator's eyes, they're meeting or exceeding the requirements set out for them as well. So there's been a big change over the last decade. No doubt it will continue to evolve as various other opportunities come up to steer us that way. So.
Thank you very much, Eric. Speaking of security, I can remember an incident about 30 years ago when a member of Greenpeace paddled a canoe up the cooling water intake for the Bruce Power Plant. And I guess by Eric's standards, that was a very risky business. Anyway, I'd like to thank Eric again for coming from so far away to provide some inside information on nuclear energy, and our questioners for drawing out all those details. I might say there's some additional information on the tables outside, and maybe most of it's been picked up by now. I saw that you were collecting it. But since you came in, there has been another booklet added out there. You may recall that Cosmos Voutsinos spoke to us on nuclear energy here last year, just about a year ago. And since then, he has published a booklet on his talk at that time, and it's available in great quantity out there. I'm pretty sure there's a copy for everyone. So thank you very much.